Thurston Moore is on record as saying that is his favorite track of all time. That was There Is a Balm in Gilead from Archie Shepp's 1969 Blasé album. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT. Check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org. Have a great night, folks.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the biggest story right now is the way that U.S. news media that claim to be deeply invested in free speech rights are showing that they only mean it sometimes, which means they don't really mean it. The New York Times ran the headline on April 25th, "Pro-Palestinian encampment spread, leading to hundreds of arrests." We are to understand and accept that people peacefully protesting their tuition and tax dollars going to support a genocide that has killed minimally 40,000 people just forces U.S. law enforcement to, whatever their will, truncheon 20-year-olds who are sitting quietly in tents and, if possible, prevent their ever working again. Yes, unapologetic neo-Nazis marching with torches chanting "Jews will not replace us," that was protected speech that we should be as a nation proud of allowing to happen. But the same outlets say students saying they oppose the mass murder of tens of thousands of people is, well, we just can't have that. People looking to corporate news media as bastions of free speech have been wrong for more than a minute, but it's becoming crystal clear now. Information is a public good, journalism is a public service, but media is a business. And the goal of media companies to appease funders and advertisers is going to bring them into conflict with the public and with some journalists who mistakenly thought they were signing up to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. We're now seeing the impacts of the reality that corporate media, as well as corporately funded universities, will always side with official power. To present students sitting quietly in tents in protest of genocide as violent terrorists. But the fact that we've been seeing it for decades as corporate media spin narratives about people of color as both violent and lazy, and storylines about the socioeconomic status quo as the best possible option, even as millions of people increasingly recognize that it means a terrible life for them, well, that's what we're up against. But many people at the same time are deeply interested in how different media telling different stories can change our understanding of our past, our present, and our future. Joseph Torres is currently senior advisor for reparative policy and programs at the group Free Press and co-author with Juan Gonzalez of News for All the People. Writer, musician, and communication strategist Colette Watson is with Black River Life, and they both are part of the project Media 2070 that aims to highlight how media can serve as a lever for racial justice and how that includes changing entrenched media narratives about Black people. Their co-authored article, "Repairing Journalism's History of Anti-Black Harm," appears in the annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. That conversation is coming up on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The idea of some form of public communal recognition and redress or reparation for Black Americans for centuries of systemic state-sanctioned harms and their lasting and continuing impact is not new. But our guest's work considers the particular meaningful and sustained harms of news media, of journalistic institutions charged with informing the public without fear or favor, that historically and currently have used their special place and power to help drive the oppression of Black and brown people through storytelling and through overt support for racist practices, policies, and ideas. Media 2070 was co-founded by Joseph Torres, who is senior advisor for reparative policy and programs at the group Free Press and co-author with Juan Gonzalez of the crucial book News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. And writer, musician, and communication strategist Colette Watson, who is co-founder of the new group Black River Life. Their co-authored article, Repairing Journalism's History of Anti-Black Harm, appears in the annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. And they both join us now by phone from Washington, D.C. and Phoenix, Arizona, respectively. Welcome back to Counterspin, Joe Torres and Colette Watson. All right. Well, crisis of journalism is going to be a phrase that a lot of listeners are familiar with. It's a conversation among people and among philanthropists about how we can save journalism. But it's unclear to us at FAIR, as to many others, if some of those folks in that conversation really understand that corporate journalism, U.S. mainstream so-called journalism, has always contained its own poison, and if they are actually willing to address that, or if the goal is more of the same elite conversations that have excluded lots of people, but to do them in a more genteel way than maybe Fox News. So I want to ask you both to start, what is missing from current diagnoses and remedies for what we're told is the crisis of journalism?
Well, I guess I'll kick us off and just say that what's missing is an acknowledgement of our media system's history of harm. And when we talk about that, Joe and I are both co-creators of the Media 2070 project. When Media 2070 talks about this, we often say that similar to our education system and our legal system, which so many people understand as oppressive, our media system is rooted in anti-blackness and in racism and racial hierarchy. Since the very beginning, when you look at the earliest colonial newspapers, which stayed afloat on the revenues that they were gaining from serving as brokers in the trafficking of enslaved African people by not only posting ads, paid ads for people who had emancipated themselves and run away, but also in the sales of enslaved folks and serving as a broker for those transactions. We know that from that earliest route right on through till now, our system of news, information, journalism, even entertainment media, book publishing, all of those are interconnected and have been rooted in upholding a myth of Black inferiority and have actually perpetuated white supremacy and even white nationalism. So you have to have that in mind whenever you are thinking about journalism and the role it has played in society and the role that we want it to play in the safe, just, multiracial democracy we want in the future. You can't achieve that without acknowledging the history of harm.
I'll add, Colette and I, we began writing this essay over a year ago for this political journal, and Colette, one of the co-creators of 2070, but also the senior director of the 2070 Project, and to recent weeks. And what we'll try to do in this essay is to, there is a big debate happening right now about the future of journalism and how it goes. It's mostly a white-led space.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the discussion has taken place is that democracy is in crisis, and so is journalism. And if we need to save local journalism to save democracy. But as Colette is describing, what does that acknowledge is the role of local newsrooms and local journalism in undermining democracy for Black people and people of color. So we say, when hasn't, you know, the Media 2070 Project, we're asking the question, they say, when hasn't journalism been in crisis for Black people?
Mm-hmm.
And when hasn't democracy and these media institutions played a direct role in undermining democracy? In recent years, we have, like, the Los Angeles Times apologizing for being the paper of white supremacy for at least the first 80-plus years. You have the Oregonian saying that it was a paper when it began to try to ensure that Oregonian remained a white state. The Baltimore Sun apologizing for its role in upholding housing segregation and its editorials in the newspapers in support of it. In Baltimore and the Kansas City Star, much to the same. Philadelphia Inquirer apologized. These are all just within recent years. And within the future of journalism debate, there isn't even acknowledgement that like this actually happened. Like these papers have actually apologized. What are we creating that's different?
Right.
Right. How do we address issues of racial hierarchy that these institutions have played a role in undermining democracy for Black folks and for other folks of color? So if we think the current democracy be equated with the right to vote and equal protection rights being, you know, reinstated 60 years ago, local journalism, white dominant news organizations have played a role in undermining democracy, so-called democracy for Black folks and other folks of color since the get-go and still are today. And so we're just trying to make an intervention into this debate because the debate is happening. There's a lot of money being invested in the space. There's a lot of policy work happening, not just with the federal government and local states trying to make an intervention in funding local journalism. And we're afraid we're just going to be replicating the same kind of harms.
Yeah, saving democracy via local journalism seems to mean for a lot of folks just shore up and sustain these local journalistic outlets. There's the missing piece of acknowledgement of the harms that those outlets have done, you know, and it's clear that some people view the whole idea of reparations more broadly as something bad happened to people in the past, and so people that, you know, look like them, to put it crudely, are looking for resources now, you know. But I feel that particularly if you look internationally, and even within this country, that understanding is shifting so that people see not just that harms on individuals, but on communities are unending, but also that they see that truth and reconciliation processes that they've seen in South Africa or in Argentina or in Salvador, for example, they involve healing for the whole community. And the starting place, though, is not only about debts unpaid, but it's about acknowledging that there's been a distorted understanding of history, that everyone has been harmed, particularly the people who have been specifically oppressed and harmed. But reparation involves acknowledgement first. It's not a question of throwing money at the issue. There is an acknowledgement and a truth-telling that has to happen first. That's my rambling. You can call that a question, but you know what I'm saying, that it's not enough to say, oh, we did a bad thing, as some papers are doing. You know, back in the 18-dickety-doo, we wrote a bad thing, but we're sorry about it. That's not what is being called for.
Absolutely. And I think one key part of this is really seeking to broaden not only our sense of journalism and its history and its future, but our sense of what repair and reparation involve. When we created the Media Reparations Project, we also sought to really spread the understanding that reparations has to be a holistic process. We took a lot of inspiration and leadership from people who have been fighting for reparations ever since emancipation. Mm-hmm. And when we're speaking to, you know, what reparations is all about, often in community, people sort of reduce it to this idea of a check. You know, as you just said, Janine, it's not this one-time apology or even a one-time payment. You know, it has to be holistic and understood as a process, a journey rather than a destination. And speaking of folks, we took inspiration from, you know, our friends at Liberation Ventures, which is a reparations organization. They describe reparations as a comprehensive process that involves reckoning, acknowledgement, accountability, and redress. And when you're talking about the realm, you know, of journalism, Joe mentioned a couple of different platforms and papers that have issued apologies and sort of stopped there. And we know that this entire conversation around the future of journalism is one that should really inform what next after the apology and after the investigation. What is it that newspapers and other media platforms can and should be doing to rectify the different types of harm, you know, that they have wrought, whether that be sensationalistic headlines and false headlines that led to racial terrorism and lynchings, whether that be the ways that even to this very day, it's nearly impossible for journalists to sustain careers because of the toxicity in newsrooms. Right. And, you know, there's so much more that we could name, but it has to be an ongoing process that's engaged with people who have been directly impacted and defined by community.
When we're talking about these papers, we talk about narratives, right? And narratives are a political tool. Narratives are used by those in power in these media companies to uphold racial hierarchy. And uphold racial hierarchy means, like, not just within their newsrooms, but within the society as well. So these newsrooms are playing an outsized role in shaping what local communities look like. And we talked about the example of segregation in Baltimore and wealth creation and wealth death and all that. And so these media companies are playing a role in reinforcing the racial hierarchies throughout each community they serve, so whether it's schooling, housing, just name it, right? They're playing a role in shaping the society with their narratives. And because these powerful media owners are political players within the society in which they exist. And so the idea of acknowledgement is just the beginning, as Colette is saying, and you're talking about too, Janine. It has to be like, how do we get to redress? Because what's happening, they reinforce structural racism in our society in all these various ways, as I mentioned. And for us, we should focus on the media part because structural racism also exists in the media system. So for us to be able to tell our own stories, right, to own our own institutions in order to fight for racial justice, for reparations, the system is going to have to change, too, for our own communities to be able to own and control the creation and distribution of their own narratives. And so this is what we're fighting for. If we can shift how media functions, I think there's a better chance or a greater chance that we could actually address all the other underlying causes that are affecting society that newsroom play a role in promulgating, you know, in all these different ways.
Joe, I think in addition to changing the way that media has perpetuated hierarchy and harm in society, this discussion around repair and really reframing the way we understand the future of journalism conversation is also an invitation to actually save journalism. And I think that there's a lack of understanding of the fact that journalism being white dominated and being steeped in a worldview of Black inferiority and a worldview of racial hierarchy has very much been a part of why we find this industry to be faltering at this point. It's policies and culture and so much, but it's all grounded and rooted in journalism's early rootedness in racism. And what I mean when I say that is we talk a lot and we hear a lot about community trust and sort of community engagement and different things about how audiences perceive the field and how they're willing to even maybe invest in, whether that be investing time or what have you. But there's a deep distrust of journalism across communities of color because there is a deep history of harm. And then there are so many journalists of color who have tried to be truth tellers and tried to embody, you know, the true purpose of journalism in holding power to account, who have found it next to impossible to do that because of toxicity inside dominant and corporate newsrooms and because of the underfunding and underinvestment in Black serving and other serving sort of like different religious minorities and other groups, LGBTQIA plus community. You know, all of the newsrooms that serve these marginalized identities have been woefully under-resourced by the public sector and by philanthropy when compared to their white counterparts. And so whether it be on the part of journalists of color or communities of color, you know, there's this deep divide and this sense that the main kind of dominant media doesn't care about our lives, right, and doesn't think of us when they're talking about journalism and democracy. And when I talk about that to people, I like to always say there's two words you can add on in the ways you're talking about these issues of the future of journalism that'll take you so much further than where we usually go. And those two simple words are for who? Mm-hmm. Journalism for who? Mm-hmm. You know, democracy for who? Mm-hmm. Who are we serving? Carla Murphy talks about multiple mainstreams and thinking of the future of our media system as one that is steeped in serving the information needs of just so many different kinds of folks and serving the creation of conditions for different kinds of justice. And I think that when you begin to think about who we're wanting to serve and whose needs we're centering, that opens us so much more opportunity and so much more oxygen around what journalism can be. But we can't get there if we just talk about it the same old way and really are using, you know, legislation and policy ideas and philanthropy to shore up the status quo.
Absolutely. I just want to say that for some folks, this might sound like out of pocket, like it might sound like a new idea. But the truth is, this is drawing on roots. The Kerner Commission, just to say one thing, folks remember, but they remember it as saying media should do better by Black people. And that's not what it said. It said news media are failing everybody and failing the future with their white-centric perspective. You know, it challenged the whole thing. So there are historical roots that you're pulling on here. There are traditions here. There are examples here. It's not out of whole cloth. You know, there is something to connect to here that gives strength to the ideas that we're putting forward here.
Yes. I mean, Joe Torres, for my money, is one of the most incredible researchers yep. and minds that we have in this field. And I really encourage folks to dig into the essay, because throughout these pages, as you're describing, Janine, there are just so many examples from throughout history. A lot of people don't realize, for instance, that the earliest FCC broadcasting licenses were issued during the Jim Crow era, and so to white men only.
Right.
And so that leads us to the present day, where we have a media system where just a very scant percentage of our TV and radio are Black owned. And we could go on and on, because, like I said, Joe has just done exhaustive effort here in making sure that we have the evidence when we talk about this.
Yeah.
Joe, I know you don't like getting credit,
but you know, when you have to, because voids need to be filled, frankly. It's not a conversation that folks have it rhetorically. I bet there's things missing here, but they don't know what's missing. And that's why they need work like you're doing.
I appreciate, you know, Colette knows I don't like that, you know, but like, I appreciate it. And one of the things we learned in putting this essay together 4 years ago when we launched this essay was that in Chicago, there was a commission formed to study the causes of the upheaval in Chicago race riot. And it came out with a report in 1922, where they devoted a significant portion of the report to the media's role, the white media's role in fomenting this. And so here was an example of a multiracial commission that said, hey, the media, especially the white media, played a role in this racial so-called unrest, the violence that happened in this city. And then you talk about the Kerner Commission, Janine, and then 50 years later after that, what we have, like in 2020, the uprisings and all this, folks within journalism circles saying, hey, like calling on their newspapers or their media institutions to address racism in their own newsrooms. And one of the things that's really understudied, it's really an unbelievable example to me, like in 1964, the Community Relations Service was created. It became soon after that an agency with the Department of Justice, and the peacekeepers, the mediators, right? They realized early on, within the first few years mm-hmm. of its founding, that a major obstacle to integrating our society, to people adhering to Brown versus Board, was journalism with the media. And that they had to try to not just integrate the media systems, but they started to hold conferences for Black and Brown folks and for people in to how to fight license challenges against broadcast. And before the experts who came in and taught activists how to challenge broadcast license. This was within the Department of Justice, and that part of its mission was basically not funded anymore following the Nixon administration, right? Here, the government agency within the Department of Justice realizing that the biggest obstacle to people adhering to the decision of Brown versus Board and integrating our society was the media. That's another indictment, as you're saying, about the Kerner Commission a little over 50 plus years ago. And so we're still dealing with this. You know, we're still dealing that we don't have our own institutions, that the FCC, the first chairman of the FCC was the former chief justice for the Mississippi Supreme Court. Of course, like Black and Brown people want to get licenses during this era, you know, because it's all been baked in, right? It's all been baked in. And since then consolidation has only put things out of reach for us and more compounding the lack of wealth that exists in our community because of the extraction of a nation's political project, right?
Absolutely. Well, I'll just ask finally, what do folks who think media reparations, that's going to change what I get to see and hear? Is that going to restrict what I get to see and hear? Is that going to police what I get to see and hear? That's not the conversation that we're talking about having, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Joe, I will defer to you.
Well, I mean, we talk about abundance.
Yeah.
There should be an abundance of voices out there, right? And it's like there's no reason we have such a concentrated media system where you have a few companies. And, you know, here we're talking about, you know, the cable broadcast model, for example, which, you know, television is still making a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
you know, and news is driving that. So while we're talking about so-called crisis in journalism, which is, we're talking about normally print media, broadcast media is trying to get in action too and try to take the legislative effort to get their piece of the pie while they're making a lot of money, right? Broadcast stations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, it's like, how can we have abundance of Black and BIPOC media outlets out there that serve in local communities, with providing a variety of perspectives? And we're fighting for not only the variety of perspectives, but also a tether to sever the health and well-being of the community, right? Not out there for bottom-line profits, right? And to maximize profit.
Mm-hmm.
How can we have abundance of this? The idea of not what's being taken away from you, it's what's going to be added to your life to ensure the health and well-being of the communities. How's it serving the wealth, health and well-being of the need of people in local communities and local society? And this is the role in which media can play an instrumental role in ensuring that, in advocating for that, or it too often plays a detrimental role, as we see, in taking away those kind of rights that allow people to have their basic needs served, you know, in housing, in food, in schooling, right? And so, no, the vision for an abundance of media outlets that are well-funded, there's no reason why we can't do that. We invest so little in this country into media, and especially in public media, and we can create something different and something better.
That's beautiful. All right. We've been speaking with Joe Torres from Free Press and Colette Watson at Black River Life. You can tap into the work that we've been talking about at mediareparations.org. Joseph and Colette, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We're online at fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
was a little ship in South America, Key Grande, oh, the land that lies so low. There was a little ship in South America, she went by the name of the Golden Willow Tree. We hadn't been a sailing more than 2 weeks or three, crying, oh, the land that lies so low. We hadn't been a sailing more than 2 weeks or three, till we came in sight of the British Rover. Captain says, what are we gonna do? Crying, oh, the lonesome land so low. Up step the captain says, what are we gonna do if we overtake and they'll cut us in two? They'll sink us in the lowland, lonesome low. They'll sink us in the lowland so low.
Hey, kids. It's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. All right, where's my money? What? Chintzy college...
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, CNN's Jake Tapper is mad about college students protesting their institutions and their government's support for Israel's horrific attacks on Palestinians in Gaza, because they're preventing him, by his account, from covering Israel's horrific attacks on Palestinians in Gaza. Tapper whined recently, quote, "We're covering these protests and covering free speech versus security on campus. This is taking room from my show that I would normally be spending covering what is going on in Gaza or what is going on with the International Criminal Court," close quote. Tapper and CNN, we're to understand, are powerless to decide what they cover and incapable of understanding that the clear core demand of students protesting is that government and media not just chat about, but act to change U.S. enabling of Israel's genocidal assault. I don't know that the protesters are, from a media perspective, accomplishing what they want to accomplish, Tapper said. If you listen closely, you can hear him say, "We, as media, don't want them to accomplish anything except to be presented, as protesters have throughout U.S. history, as a nuisance and an interference with grown-up conversation. And we, as media, will use our actual power to sell just that idea." People in media and elsewhere who are used to unequivocal U.S. support for Israel's actions, used to summarily reducing any criticism of Israel to anti-Semitism, even when it comes from Jewish people, are seeing the ground shift, and they're shook. What happens now is critical, first for Palestinians and Israelis, of course, but also for the U.S. press and their handlers, who are so used to driving the narrative that they don't know what to do except yell, "Shut up, shut up, shut up," and send in the cops in the name of, you know, principled debate. We'll talk about latest developments in Gaza with Ahmed Abu Zned, executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. The flip side of Tapper's frustration that pro-Palestinian students won't just go away is corporate media's complaint against the national and now international campus peace encampments that many student protesters won't speak to them. The problem, pundits and reporters say, is that these encampments have designated media spokespeople. As Ari Paul writes for Fair.org, conservative columnist and former Reagan speechwriter Peggy Noonan reported her trip to the Columbia University encampment in the Wall Street Journal. Quote, "I was at Columbia hours before the police came in and liberated Hamilton Hall from its occupiers. Unlike protesters of the past, who were usually eager to share with others what they thought and why, these demonstrators would generally not speak or make eye contact with members of the press, or, as they say, corporate media." Close quote. "Friends, please come say hello and tell me what you think," I called, says the woman who has explained that Hamilton Hall was liberated by truncheon-wielding police, but alas, they would not. So, based apparently on talking to no protesters, Noonan concluded that, quote, "they weren't a compassionate group. They weren't for anything. They were against something. the Israeli state, which they'd like to see disappear, and those who support it, close quote. The New York Times' Peter Baker also told readers that the protests seen around the world were, quote, not about actually explaining your cause or trying to engage journalists who are there to listen, close quote. It takes no imaginative leap for activists to suspect that the corporate media vigorously engaged in portraying calls to halt a genocide as selfish, benighted extremism might not give them a fair shake. But, as Ari Paul notes, it's clear that student protesters around the country have organized a structure where many participants who are approached by media defer to appointed media liaisons. For Baker and Noonan, this is evidence that the protests are at best not serious and at worst not democratic. But why would such a structure even be considered unusual? Most organizations that corporate journalists cover have dedicated spokespeople to handle media inquiries, while others stay silent. Noonan's experience is no different than how many street reporters interact with the cops. Ask a cop for a comment and you'll get sent over to the public information officer. You'll rarely, if ever, see a news story that complains or even notes that a government or corporate employee directed a reporter to talk to the press office. Some restrictions on employee speech can hamper investigative reporting, for sure. But the media discipline at these protests seems more like a way to keep the message clear. And Baker and Noonan are only pretending to wonder what the messages are. The encampments want their campuses to divest from Israel, and they are also protesting their administrations and the police violence against free speech and assembly. Anyone with a press card in their hat is not entitled to the time of every individual protester, particularly given their knowledge that these reporters are hostile to their ideas. Baker and Noonan aren't upset or alarmed that student reporters covering the protests have been subjected to extreme violence by the police, a very real form of state censorship, but they still insinuate that an aversion to speak to the corporate press signifies the movement's illiberalism. Maybe, Paul concludes, establishment media are a little bit bitter that student reporters at places like Columbia University's WKCR are doing a better job of covering the unrest than some salaried professionals in the media class. If anything, what Baker and Noonan are lamenting is that the discipline of these students is making it harder for corporate media to misrepresent, ridicule, and embarrass students who are protesting the U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza. A key allegation from detractors of the student protests is that they aren't really students. These were professionals that were here, claimed New York Mayor Eric Adams on MSNBC's Morning Joe. Quote, I just want to send a clear message out that there are people who are harmful and are trying to radicalize our children, close quote. Fox 5 Good Day New York brought on NYPD Deputy Commissioner of Public Information, Tariq Shepard, and NYPD Commissioner of Operations, Kaz Daughtry, as its guests. The mayor is describing some of the people there as professional agitators, said anchor Rosanna Scotto. Are these just students? In response, Daughtry said, quote, look at the tents. They all were the same color, the same ones we saw at NYU, the same ones we see at Columbia. To me, I think someone is funding this, close quote. After an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal asserted that, quote, Rockefeller and Soros grants are subsidizing those who disrupt college campuses, close quote, the New York Post wrote that, quote, copycat tent cities have been set up at colleges including Harvard, Yale, Berkeley in California, the Ohio State University, and Emory in Georgia, all of them organized by branches of the Soros-funded Students for Justice in Palestine, close quote. Well, Snopes investigated the Post's claims and found no evidence that Soros had funded Students for Justice in Palestine. Meanwhile, Hellgate had checked Daughtry's theory of a secret tent funder through advanced data gathering. They Googled it. As it turned out, there was a much simpler explanation for the similar tents. They were the cheapest ones available online, as little as $15. My God, reported the news site. Looks like what we've got on our hands is a classic case of college students buying something cheap and disposable. On Morning Joe, Mayor Adams and the NYPD's Shepard introduced another item that viewers were ominously told was a clear sign of outside agitators being behind the protests. "Tell us," asked co-host Mika Brzezinski, "about this chain." Shepard lifted up a heavy metal chain, declaring, quote, "This is not what students bring to school. This is what professionals bring to campuses and universities. And this is what we encountered on every door inside of Hamilton Hall," close quote. Well, that story held up about as well as the one about the tents. New York Times visual investigations reporter Eric Toller pointed out that the exact same chain was not only used by Columbia students, it was in fact sold by the university's own public safety department under its crime prevention discount bike, locker, and laptop lock program. Media around the country have been relying on police as sometimes their sole sources on campus protests, as when CNN reported on violent clashes ongoing at UCLA by citing a tweet from the Los Angeles Police Department that, due to multiple acts of violence, police were responding to restore order. In fact, the incident turned out to be an attack by a violent pro-Israel mob on the student encampment, as noted by the LA Times and others. As DeMoss reminds, it's been clear for decades, if not centuries, that law enforcement are unreliable narrators. That's why journalism groups like Harvard University's Nieman Foundation have called for news outlets to stop treating police statements as neutral sources of information. Or as Susan Chira, editor-in-chief at the Marshall Project, put it, "Police said is not a shorthand for truth." Finally, New York Mayor Adams' charge that outside agitators are trying to radicalize our children was echoed by lawmakers moving to shut down TikTok. Saying the quiet part loud, Senator Mitt Romney told a forum that, quote, "the number of mentions of Palestinians on TikTok generated overwhelming support to shut the app down," close quote. New York Representative Mike Lawler stated that the Gaza protests are, quote, "exactly why we included the TikTok bill in the foreign supplemental aid package, because you're seeing how these kids are being manipulated by certain groups or entities or countries to foment hate on their behalf and really create a hostile environment here in the U.S., close quote. On Fair.org, Julianne Tweeten outlines the move against TikTok and the strange idea that it's really about reining in big tech in the interests of privacy. But as she notes, these open admissions that Congress went after TikTok based on its content will likely help the lawsuit TikTok's owner ByteDance filed, arguing that the law mandating either a sale or a ban is unconstitutional. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Beltway reporters have access to things others can't see, but can they see things that aren't there? That question was brought to mind by a May 8th piece by New York Times chief White House reporter Peter Baker, in which he interpreted Biden's evident decision to pause delivery of certain types of bombs to Israel as, quote, "meant to convey a powerful signal that his patience has limits," close quote. Israel's plans to storm the southern Gaza city of Rafah, Baker explains, have been a source of intense friction with the Biden administration for months. That friction was evidently expressed in the unfettered delivery of weapons during those months and the publicly expressed support for the catastrophic violence that has killed, maimed, orphaned, and displaced millions of Palestinians, destroyed their homes and infrastructure, and denied their access to humanitarian aid. Others, more focused on actions than vibes, saw the step as overdue but necessary if it is part of some serious effort to condition any U.S. support for Israel on ending the bloodshed. Ahmed Abuzned is executive director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He joins us now by phone from D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ahmed Abuzned.
Thank you, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, an invasion of Rafah, we were told, would be an uncrossable red line for Biden. But luckily enough, a New York Times headline says, attack not seen as full invasion. Seen as being the kind of slippery language media use to suggest something they'd rather not say, that only some people's definitions matter. What do we know about what's happening in Rafah right now? Is it surprising? And why would we accept that it doesn't amount to invasion?
Well, we shouldn't accept that assessment. Israelis have been saying they're going to invade Rafah no matter what. They said they would continue with their quote-unquote mission no matter what. Benjamin Netanyahu just gave a speech and said, despite any pressures or response from outside forces or international forums, Israel will continue. So I think what's really the question here is whether President Biden issued his red line in actual red or in pencil. We're going to find out because, you know, technicalities as to how they view the invasion of Rafah aside, not only has it already occurred, but they've clearly made the statement again that they're going to continue. So I think really the ball is in President Biden's court. Will he continue to be bullied around and told what to do by Netanyahu, or will he act like he's the president of the U.S. and call for an end?
Well, is the pause, and it's been called, some people have saying he's stopped giving weapons. That's not it. It's been called a pause or a delay in the delivery of certain types of bombs. Is that meaningful? How meaningful is that?
You know, that's not meaningful. And I'll tell you why, because in the last few months, there has been shipment after shipment after shipment to Israel. And so to now say that you would pause or have paused certain munitions, there's a little too late. Israel may not, in fact, need what you paused in order to, again, conduct its invasion of Rafah. So are you going to end the genocide, President Biden? That's the central question. People aren't asking for a pause right now. They're asking for an end to the genocide and an end to military weaponry to Israel. So it's clear President Biden is still not reading the room.
Yeah. Well, in general, it feels as though the options or the hopes are so tamped down. You know, ceasefire seems like the ultimate thing that we can call for, you know, but ceasefire doesn't bring people back to life. It doesn't put Gazans back in their destroyed homes. I mean, obviously, ceasefire, but where would that fit in with what else needs to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the ceasefire is the most immediate demand, and that's why if President Biden had made this threat via weapons months ago, there literally may have been thousands of lives saved. And so the ceasefire is still the first and most urgent demand because we're trying to save lives. The people in Gaza are not only facing, again, the incredibly brutal and violent genocidal assaults, they're also facing forced starvation. There was this huge conversation around aid trucks beginning to increase. And now here we are again with, you know, aid trucks essentially coming to a halt. So the genocide is real, and that's the first and most important demand in this moment. But beyond that, after what the U.S. taxpayer, after what the West, after what elected officials have witnessed, how can they continue to go back to the status quo of supporting the state of Israel, even if there's a ceasefire? I would argue that it's clear to most Americans at this point that the Israeli government cannot be trusted with our weapons. They've taken it so far at this point with their genocidal conduct, there's actually no turning back. And so ceasefire fits in, again, prominently because we need to stop the bloodshed, stop the starvation, stop the siege. But beyond that, we need to make sure this can never happen again. And to make sure this can never happen again, that means that the state of Israel must not receive any more U.S. arms, period. The U.S. should no longer protect Israel at the International Criminal Court, period. The U.S. should no longer protect the state of Israel at the International Court of Justice, period. These are all ways that Israel deserves to be isolated in this moment. And in fact, many countries are already taking that necessary step. We've seen Colombia, for instance, cease any relations with the state of Israel. And that's what's required of the world right now, especially of the United States, a country that proclaims itself to be one of those leaders of the quote-unquote free world and supportive of people's self-determination and calls for freedom and justice. If the U.S. is truly that, this is the moment to show it. And so we're way beyond the ceasefire. We need a ceasefire immediately, but we need to see some divestment from the Israeli apartheid state, divestment from the genocidal state, and sanctions on the genocidal apartheid state.
Well, there's a feeling that the masks are off. Legislators in this country aren't saying, as they supply Israel with money and bombs and political shielding in international bodies, they aren't saying, we hope for peace, but it's hard, and Israel is our friend. They're now saying, if you don't full-throatedly support Israel's ethnic cleansing project, you're a terrorist supporter, which, by the way, means you're a terrorist, and we will see that you are treated accordingly. That sentiment has always been there, of course, but it's still shocking what people are now okay saying out loud and doing, like, you know, H.R. 6408, legislation to define pro-Palestinian groups as terrorist supporting and strip their tax-exempt status. How are groups like U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights responding to these very overt and meaningful legislative threats?
Well, look, they've attempted to stifle BDS and criminalize boycotts of Israel. You know, they've attempted to make people pay via loss of state-awarded contracts and agreements, right? You would sign this pledge. We've seen, of course, lawsuits and lawfare utilized, such as the lawsuit that was levied against the U.S. campaign. And you know what? We fought that and we won. And so this is actually another overreach, another violation of our constitutional rights, another mode of repression against Palestinian organizing and activism. But the fact of the matter is, this isn't going to stop us. If they think that a piece of legislation like this is going to cause us to cease our advocacy, our activities, our organizing, our shutting it down for Palestine, then they've miscalculated. So what we'll see is that this will be utilized by the state to attempt to repress and suppress the movement, just like the anti-BDS laws, just like these lawfare expeditions, but it won't stop. It won't allow for them to achieve their goal. They won't silence us. They won't stop us. And if at the end of the day we have to suffer through losing tax-exempt status, I think the organizations that right now are doing anything they can to stop a genocide, I think they'll gladly sacrifice tax-exempt status. But I hope it doesn't come to that, because it's clearly a violation of our First Amendment rights and our constitutional rights to organize in this country.
It seems like something has fundamentally changed in terms of the U.S. public, and of course we're seeing it at this with college students, but it's been there before. It feels like, you know, flailing on the part of the administration and on the part of people who want an uncritical support for anything that Israel does and want support for genocide. The students are just driving them mad, and yet there they are still doing it. Does this feel like a shift to you? I know you're not a psychic, but does it seem like something is changing?
Oh, it's absolutely changing. Look, you know, millions of people have taken action in the last few months, and that's been, you know, calls, letters, petition, direct action, civil disobedience, marches, protests, rallies, you know, bird dogging, I mean, you name it. And now we see encampment, and the students, just like they rose up against the war in Vietnam, just like they rose up, you know, for the civil rights movement, just like they rose up against the war in Iraq, you know, the students will continue to be just a huge, huge part of this movement. And right now they're speaking clearly to this country, not only about Palestine and our need to get a ceasefire and to divest, right? Their demands are super clear. They're super prepared. They're super disciplined and intentional. I'm so proud of them. But not only are they making these demands clear for us in relation to Palestine, they're also giving us, in plain sight, a contradiction for us to understand and grapple with domestically. Do we want continued militarization of police, not only in our communities, but on our college campuses. This is what we're witnessing, riot gears, dispersal techniques used on our students at Ivy League institutions, at non-Ivy League institutions, literally the weight of policing being levied against students from the ages of 17 to the 20s. And it's not only a concern that we're seeing this, obviously, under a supposed Democratic progressive president. We can see that this is something we should be concerned about, not only now, but in the future here for this country, as we see this intense militarization of our college campuses.
Well, let me just say, to me, on some level, the media's focus on leverage that focuses on, you know, Joe is kind of irked at BB. Uh-oh. It feels condescending to me, this great man theory of history that's going on, like it's a personal conversation between Joe Biden and Netanyahu. It seems to kind of make a mockery of international law and of human rights, frankly. And I just wonder what other lenses could media be using? What other things could media be focusing on that would take it away from, like, there's a personal fight between these two guys and somehow millions of people are affected by it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what media can do is continue to center the horrific nature of this Israeli assault, this genocidal assault on Gaza. The statistics, the data, the stories, the just devastation that we're seeing in Rafah right now. I think centering those voices and that experience, and then thinking about, again, our role is where the focus needs to be. You know, the conversations between President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu are for them to have. What we're asking for is action. And we're not going to be satisfied with these leaks of displeasure or of tension or of fracturing friendships. This isn't about friendships. This is about stopping a genocide. And unfortunately, right now, not only are we not stopping it, we're arming it and supporting it.
We've been speaking with Ahmed Abuzned. He's executive director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Thank you so much, Ahmed Abuzned, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter extra and to show much needed support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.